KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. When Julianne Moore was starting out in the late 1980s, she got offered a part playing twins on the now-defunct soap opera As the World Turns. Maybe it wasn't the most prestigious gig, but Moore says people trying to break into the business shouldn't be snobs.
Sometimes young actors say, like, I don't know, what am I going to do? How am I going to choose? I'm like, you're just going to do what you are offered. There's not that much to choose from when you're first starting out. I'm just work. You don't have to be somewhere forever, but you learn a lot just by actually working.
That soap won Moore a Daytime Emmy, and now she has an Oscar too. Moore talks about how she picks her projects and why she's not afraid to work with first-time directors, one of whom, Bart Freundlich, later became her husband. Today, Moore and Freundlich join us to talk about the first film they made together, The Myth of Fingerprints, and their latest collaboration, an English-language remake of the Danish film After the Wedding. But first on the News Banter, the triumph of Shari Redstone. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I'm joined by my colleague in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
Well, so Shari Redstone has finally prevailed in her struggle, a long struggle, to bring together these two big pieces of the empire assembled by her father, Sumner Redstone, CBS and Viacom, Viacom being the parent of MTV and Nickelodeon and the Paramount movie studio and other assets. She had a struggle. Now, first of all, let's start with her father, Sumner, still alive, very, very old, hasn't been seen in public in years. He was really mean to her. He called her horrible names in front of people in board meetings. He disparaged her. He said she would never, ever be running the company. You know, he ran a little hot and cold, but when he was cold, he was ice cold. And then he became, you know, gradually more enfeebled and caught up in this sordid world of living with younger lady friends who seemed to be running his life. And she first had to fight off these two women who particularly had taken up residence with him. And this was litigation, and it got very ugly. I mean, all kinds of allegations flying back and forth about who did what to whom. Really sordid, sordid stuff. She not only had that fight, she had to fend off Philippe Doman, who was the chairman of Viacom, and she had to deal with Les Moonves, super powerful head of CBS.
Yeah, I mean, this sounds like the plot of the season of Succession, not a real life media company, but she really has had to overcome, and it is overcoming, all of this drama to emerge as the leader of this combined company, assuming that the merger goes through. But this is only the beginning. I mean, the real question here is, what is the ultimate end game for this Viacom CBS company? Because they're going to have a market cap of about $30 billion and some great media assets. But when you look at the landscape right now and you're dealing with AT&T, which is at $225 billion, you're dealing with Disney, Netflix, you know, Amazon, all of these tech companies that are coming into the content space, Viacom CBS is going to be very, very small compared to these others. So are they going to be a buyer or are they going to be a seller?
Short term, this is just my prediction, they'll buy some stuff to bulk up and try to present themselves as a viable thing. But I have to feel, you know, I know it would be anathema in a way for, I don't know what her mindset is, but it would be anathema in a way for her to say, I'm going to sell. But I don't know, maybe realistically, she doesn't have much choice. But for now, I'm sure the position would be, you know, we are fantastic and we're running. They have multiple streaming services that they are going to run. Their strategy is quite different from the strategy being pursued by, say, Warner Media.
Yeah, I mean, they really want to have a diversity of kind of ways into the company, whereas Warner Media has said, we are going to combine a lot of these assets, create HBO Max, which is going to be our premium, you know, Netflix-like service for all kinds of content. And they're using the HBO brand to leverage that and upsell, essentially, and to use an AT&T term. Viacom is different. They are going to be niche. They have a kids service. They have BET Plus, which is primarily aimed at African-American audiences. They have Pluto TV, which is this free service that they acquired, and they're adding content to that. You know, it's really a multi-pronged effort, and they want to be a so-called arms dealer where they are able to do deals with a bunch of these other services, like the deal that Paramount has to make films specifically for Netflix. They want to be able to sell their content to all the highest bidders.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's been one of the sticking points has been just how troubled Viacom was compared with CBS. You know, for a long time, CBS was doing pretty well, admittedly, primarily in the broadcast space, which is challenged, but still holding on and turning in a dominant performance. Viacom had been very much neglected, I think, as I said, about by Philippe Daumont. And, you know, the idea that shareholders might sue seems possible. I mean, one of them has already been making those noises because the feeling was that CBS shareholders are going to be unfairly saddled with Viacom. Now, Viacom's Bob Bakish, who's now running the whole thing, has done what he can and made some steps to make Viacom healthier. But this lawsuit could happen because you have a situation, again, I don't know, it's the healthiest thing. Shari Redstone still controls a great majority of voting stock. So even if you're an investor, you're watching ahead of the company who can do as she or previously her father, he chooses.
Yeah, and that was always the Les Moonves argument for keeping these companies separate. You know, CBS had its own strength and trajectory, and Viacom was seen as the lesser of the assets, more troubled. But, you know, this has always been a family-controlled company or group of companies. And I think that's been baked into a lot of the stock concerns. And there's really not as much of a regulatory issue here because they were previously together and were split in the mid-2000s. I don't see the combination here raising either regulatory or legal flags the same way that people said that the Time Warner AT&T merger or even the Disney-Fox merger might have caused some red flags.
I might have said especially the Disney-Fox merger. Yeah, I mean, many people feel that what Shari Redstone is really doing is correcting a mistake that her father made, you know, that he split these two companies apart. And a lot of people feel like one of his motives was he was trying to keep highly valued executives at the time and make Les Moonves happy and make this one and that one happy. And so giving them each their domain to run. And a lot of people thought, you know, how does that make sense? And the long-term answer is it didn't.
It didn't, but now, you know, they've got this combined company. It is her company. It is not her father's company anymore. And she's got to figure out what the strategy is long-term.
And it will be closely watched. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. The new drama, After the Wedding, is a gender-swapped remake of a 2006 Danish movie of the same name, directed by Suzanne Beer. In this American version, Michelle Williams plays the saintly Isabel, who devotes her life to a money-strapped orphanage in India. The plot thickens when Isabel learns that a wealthy American might be willing to make a major donation. While Isabel hates to step away from her work, the donor insists that she come to New York and make her pitch in person. When Isabel meets Teresa, a high-powered CEO played by Julianne Moore, she's eager to state her case and leave. But Teresa isn't ready to listen.
So we have a list of priorities.
I have the caterers on the line.
I'm really sorry about that. You just caught me at a very busy time. My daughter's getting married this weekend.
Desperate for the donation, Isabel agrees when Teresa insists that she come to the wedding. It soon becomes clear that Teresa's motives for bringing Isabel to New York are complicated. The director of After the Wedding is Bart Freundlich, who also happens to be married to Julianne Moore. This is the fourth film they've made together. Moore has been nominated for Oscar 5 times and won Best Actress in 2015 for her role in Still Alice. She's one of a small number of performers to have been nominated for 2 Oscars in the same year. In 2003, she was up for her roles in The Hours and Far From Heaven. We recently sat down with Freundlich and Moore, and if you hear me call her Julie instead of Julianne, trust me, it's only because she said that's what she likes to be called. We started out by winding back the clock just a few years to when Moore was in high school. You had this teacher in high school, mm-hmm. I read.
I did, yeah.
And she
yeah.
was one of those teachers who sees it, tells you you've got it.
She was just the high school English teacher who was also the drama, you know, head of the drama club, whatever. So she and directed all the plays. And she said to me, you know, I think you're really good and I think you can do this for a living. And I'd never really met an actor. I didn't know people could make a living acting. So she handed me a copy of Dramatics magazine, actually, with all these schools in it. And I came home and said to my parents, I'm going to be an actor. And I'm going to choose a school from this magazine.
Right.
And my parents, you know, I was an academic kid and they just assumed I would do something and go to graduate school. And they said, okay, our only stipulation is that you get an undergraduate degree. You can't go to a conservatory, which I thought was fair, honestly. And I said, if I auditioned to these schools and I didn't get in, I would just do regular liberal arts. And I got in. So that's what happened.
And thus it began. We had Elizabeth Banks on the show recently, actually.
Yeah.
And she said that she talked to you, among others, and said, what should I do? And you said indie films. And she said, yeah, that didn't work for me.
That wasn't her thing. Yeah, yeah. You know?
Well, I mean, it just didn't quite go the same way. But it was. But she talked about turning down a soap earlier in her career. But you did it. She turned it down, which I was amazed because she's very intense, very ambitious. Yeah. That is super clear. But she somehow held off. But you went for it. You won an Emmy.
I just wanted a job. You know, I mean, I felt very responsible, very young. And, you know, my parents had paid for my education, which was a very big deal. I didn't take out any loans. They took out the loans. And so, you know, when I moved to the city and I had an agent, I worked, you know, I had a couple of little jobs in theater and I had, I think, 6 episodes on a soap and I did a couple of little commercials. But then I was offered this 3-year contract and it was a big deal. And I think I wanted the stability. And a lot of my friends turned it down too. They wouldn't, there are a lot of people I knew who wouldn't do soaps. And
they just felt like it was the mark of something.
I don't know. I just felt like I wanted to work and I wanted to learn. I wanted to be able to support myself. And so that's all I cared
about.
So
if somebody asked you, would you say do it? It's way to go. I mean, I don't even know how. I guess they're still on.
No, they're not. They're barely
there's
on.
One, right?
There's one left. I think there's almost nothing left. But I think what I always say, sometimes young actors say, like, I don't know. What am I going to do? How am I going to choose? I'm like, you're just going to do what you are offered. There's not that much to choose from when you're first starting out. I'm like, just work. You don't have to be somewhere forever, but you learn a lot just by actually working.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah.
So we're going to take a large leap forward in time.
Okay.
To 1995, where you guys meet on this movie, The Myth of Fingerprints.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was my first film. I was 25 and I had this pipe dream that she was going to do my movie. And everyone told me, no, she's never going to do your movie, from agents to producers. And I guess I was just naive enough at that point to keep going forward and keep hoping. And then she did respond to the script and we had a meeting. And it was a very short meeting, and I thought it hadn't gone well. And she went across the room to another meeting
with my agent.
With her agent and said, I'm going to do that kid's movie.
That's right.
That kid.
Yeah, yeah.
What was it? I mean, because we ultimately marry the kid, so maybe.
Yeah,
I
did.
That was in your mind. Like, he's cute.
No, you know what? I didn't even remember what he looked like. That was what was interesting. I really was impressed by the script and the clarity of his vision. I think when I meet with people, I always really want to know, I need for them to tell me how they see the movie, why they want me to do it, and how I can interpret that, just because I need to be able to do that as an actor. And if they're able to tell me, then I think, wow, okay, they really have a vision for this and a vision that I'm going to be able to fulfill for them. If somebody says, well, you know, I just want you to do it because I think you're really talented, or really, you know, which is, can be nice, you know, people can compliment you, but that doesn't mean that
doesn't move the needle necessarily.
Well, you want to be able to communicate with them. And Bart was very, very clear about what he wanted and what he saw in my work. And I was really impressed with the other actors that he had chosen and with the script. So I was like, oh, this guy's has a really wonderful point of view.
I read somewhere that one of the things you told her, which I thought was such a striking thing, was that you had said, your face changes when you smile.
Yeah. I think I said something like
that,
didn't I?
Yeah, it was about my duality.
There was a duality. So it was such a duality. And there was a duality in this character for sure. Someone who was, she was very angry, disappointed in life, but you felt this life force from her. Mm-hmm. And I recognized in her other work that I had loved, especially Vanya on 42nd Street, I think, that she was like a different person when she smiled. Everything changed. And she obviously has such a huge inner life, and that's what makes her who she is, really. So, but I was able to articulate that somehow in amongst the fear of having the meeting and not being able to believe it, I was able to articulate that while moving the salt and pepper shakers around a lot.
Nervously, yeah. I'm trying to process getting an actor like Julianne Moore in your first film.
Yeah.
That would be scary, wouldn't it? I mean, even you can say that would be scary. No?
I certainly didn't feel that way at the time. You know, I mean, I wouldn't. What's interesting is I work with so many first time directors, because at that time in the 90s, that was the heyday of the independent film movement. And there were all these emerging voices, and they were emerging through their scripts. That's how I would find out about them. I'd read their scripts, and their voices were so electric and interesting. And so my feeling was, if somebody could write that way and they could articulate what they'd written about and their vision, then I was like, I was all in. So from my point of view, I didn't think of it as scary, but I also know that I think in the 90s, things were moving really quickly. There were a lot of movies being made and stuff. So,
well, you were the person, so you weren't intimidated by yourself. You
know? Yeah, I think that helps when you're the person and everybody else gets to be intimidated. But, you know, you still seem to do that. I was thinking about the people we've had. I mean, we interviewed Richard Glatzer and Westmoreland when Richard Glatzer was actually very, very ill. But that was still Alice. And then we had Sebastian Lillo on for a combo platter, actually a little bit of Gloria Bell, but also Fantastic Woman.
Right.
And you really haven't stopped doing that zigging and zagging.
Yeah, that's the most exciting thing about what we do in film, I think, is finding these stories that seem, you know, they say the thing about tragedy, that there's something about tragedy that always seems inevitable. Do you know, there's something about like a great directorial voice that feels that way too. You see something that seems brand new, but you're like, oh, but I feel like it's been here all the time. Why didn't I see it? So there's something about an emerging voice when you see it, you're like, Oh, of course, of course.
Think it's a risk though, doesn't it feel like a risk at this point? You're so, in a way, you're so established, I guess you can do it. Right. But in another way, you sort of feel like, you know, am I going to trust this person?
Except that I always feel that there's evidence, that the evidence is there. Like I said, it feels like it's been established somehow by what they've presented.
By the words on the page.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this movie, when you decide you're going to do something together, how does that come to be? I mean, do you sort of go like, so it's been a while. Right.
I think it's more straightforward than might be interesting. Right. But Julie, as she was just alluding to, is so much about script and so much about the words that we know we like to work together. In fact, I think we've worked together more than any other director you've worked with. Right?
Mm-hmm. It's the same actually as Todd.
Oh, it's Todd. Yeah. It's Todd Haynes.
Right.
I'm willing to be in that boat.
Yeah.
Take it.
But it's not enough for me to say, hey, I have a great idea. This is the idea and this is the character. She wants to see the screenplay. I think in part just because, from what I understand, that you know that's your way in. Mm-hmm. And it's not even about deeming whether it's good enough for you. It's like, do you connect to those words?
Exactly. Yeah.
And so one, there has to be a role that's substantive enough.
Right.
And this movie had something so unusual about it. And I knew it was something that Julie hadn't explored fully and it was expressing interest in. It just happened to be that it was a man playing the role.
Right. So yes, this was based on this Danish film and it was brought to you as a project.
It was. It was this producer, Joel Michaels, who fell in love with Suzanne's movie and fought to keep the rights for about 12 years and then found me about 3 years ago. And there wasn't a lot of reason to remake such a good movie, I felt, except just to put it in English. And that wasn't enough reason for me. So Julie saw the movie.
Were you familiar with the film?
I was familiar with Suzanne's work and loved it, but I wasn't familiar with After the Wedding.
Yeah, I hadn't seen it either. So we just watched it together because he was watching it to consider adapting it.
And I loved it. It took me a long time to figure out why it was a good idea to remake this movie. I just didn't want to diminish her work. And it feels very strange to be—
Being Suzanne's.
Yeah, Suzanne's work. So it really wasn't until we started exploring this idea, Julie expressed interest in—
It was Rolf Lansgaard who plays he's a Swedish actor who plays the businessman in Suzanne's movie. And I was fascinated by him. I loved his—
Just to be clear, that's the character you ultimately became.
That's the character, yes. Mm-hmm. He had so much power and size and it was so unpredictable and so opaque. And when the movie ended, I looked at Bart and I said, wow, I said, that's a part I'd like to play, but with no idea that it would ever be possible.
That he would. Yeah. Did that give you the idea to say,
No, it didn't, honestly. No. What? Okay. But I was talking, I was talking to the producers at that point and one of them said, well, why don't you try writing it as two women? And I thought, that's just so Hollywood. That's like, okay, now we're going to change the genders. But I thought, well, it's not working for me just trying to adapt it straightforward and changing the city.
You did make a shot in it.
Yeah, I did. I started to think about it. It just didn't spark.
It's like, why am I?
Yeah, it just didn't spark. I couldn't make it my
here?
Own.
Yeah.
And so then I thought, I took a couple of months and I started following hand over hand what it would mean for the narrative to change the men to women, which was a fascinating sociological experiment also, because there were certain things, many things that didn't take any adapting. change the gender. And then there were a few things.
I was trying to sort of mentally review what has to change and what doesn't.
Yeah, well, there was a big, huge plot point that had to change.
Yeah.
That's hard, that we don't want to reveal.
Yeah.
Right.
But there's a huge plot point that has to change.
I think I can guess.
Yeah.
Right.
And I thought I was going to run into a brick wall with that plot point. But instead, the way in which I got around that was the thing that kind of lit the fire.
It elevates the whole story and makes it so much, everybody's made such a considered decision and then it ends up having tremendous ramifications. And so it's very exciting dramatically.
I just started to see how I could put myself into this movie, and it wasn't just going to be a Suzanne's movie that we were using as, and we were imitating. Instead, we were kind of inspired by it, is
exactly,
the way it felt.
Yeah.
Coming up after a short break, Julianne Moore shares her support for the Me Too movement and tells us about her creepy run-ins with creepy director James Toback. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? Critics rave The Greatest Hits is a music-infused romance that hits all the right notes and the most original time travel story in years. Featuring music by Nelly Furtado, Beach House, Jamie XX, and more. Watch The Greatest Hits, now streaming on Hulu.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Julianne Moore and her husband, writer-director Bart Freundlich. Their new film, After the Wedding, is in theaters now. In After the Wedding, Michelle Williams plays Isabel, a woman who lives very simply in India, working for an orphanage. Moore plays Teresa, the wealthy CEO of a media company who says she might make a large donation to Isabel's orphanage, but only if Isabel comes to see her in New York. Once Isabel arrives, Teresa insists that she comes to her daughter's wedding. The whole situation confuses Isabel until she arrives at the celebration and encounters Teresa's husband, played by Billy Crudup. It's quickly obvious that Isabel and Oscar have met before.
Hi, good, you made it.
I was a little bit late. I missed the first part, the traffic.
Well, that's
we were stuck
okay.
On
you're
the...
here now. That's all that matters. You met my husband? Yeah? So Isabel runs an orphanage in India that I'm thinking of funding.
Oh.
Yeah. And so I thought it'd be nice if you could come.
After the Wedding is a reimagining of an Oscar-nominated 2006 Danish film of the same name, directed by Suzanne Beer. Producers approached Freundlich about making a U.S. version of the film, but the task did not prove easy.
When the project came to me, it was with the rights and a lot of passion.
It's
part of it, but we needed to, we did it the old fashioned way. Like I've been doing it since we made Myth of Fingerprints, which is you get the cast attached. The cast means something to some financiers. They like the story. They like the script. And then they say, maybe.
Yeah.
You <know? laughs> But you have Julie and then is it go from there to
Michelle.
Michelle and then Billy.
And then Billy, yeah.
And then you go out and say, I have this amazing cast.
Yeah, well we pretty much had it when we had Julie and Michelle.
Right.
And then Billy was gonna be doing something else, and I've worked with him. This is my third time. But it ended up that other thing fell through and I was like, please. But the money really came mainly from Julie's involvement early on. And we went ahead and took it to the Berlin Film Festival with the script and Julie. It's like an old story from the 90s. And you pre-sell territories and you bank the money against that.
Bit
and
by
it's,
bit.
You know, it's bit by bit. And then you get 6 weeks out and someone says, oh, remember that money I was going to give you? Forget it. And then you go, help. You know? And,
right.
I mean, it really is like by the skin of our teeth.
Yeah, nail biter, really.
It really is. And I'm glad we did, but it was very hard.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And, you know, it's like there aren't so many projects like this now.
No. And we were just saying that because Sony Classics, who's distributing this here, distributed and financed Myth of Fingerprints. And that's,
Tom and Michael.
Yeah, they're very, I mean, when I went back to the list of movies they've distributed, I was like, oh my God, this is such a victory to have them put their stamp on this movie, because it's just good movie after good movie. And
yes, well, I'll say it, you don't have to. They don't have the reputation for being the easiest when it comes to the deal making.
Well, I guess it's
kept them alive. I mean, and that's the thing that's amazing.
They've
been very judicious
taste.
in their choices. Yeah.
So you premiered Sundance, and to be fair and frank, the reviews were a little
mixed. I would say
mixed, or not what you would have dreamed.
No, right. not 100% across the board.
Right.
That changed my life. That would be the only thing that would work for me.
Yes, I can easily imagine that. It's always like you remember the one bad one if there's one.
Of course.
75 good ones. What is that guy talking about? But you recut it, I think, to some degree.
We didn't recut. We remixed the movie and remixed the music, which was something I had wanted to do anyway. And although that sounds like a small thing for many movies, it is. It was a big deal for us because this movie is a big melodrama. And the way we decided to approach this was with as much reality, as much subtle humanity as possible, and still let these big events exist. So mm-hmm. if you score it and you overscore it and you indicate to the audience what to feel, it could have a really negative effect. Mm-hmm. And the score is absolutely gorgeous. This composer, Michael Dana, who won an Academy Award for Life of Pi and did all of Adam McGuigan's movies, and is just so great. He did a beautiful score, and we didn't have the time to mix it in the way we wanted to mm-hmm. before Sundance. So we remixed, and I think that that's made a big difference. And I also found in the reaction to the movie, it seems to be a movie that speaks to the audience. There's so many different ways in emotionally. I had people waiting to talk to me after Sundance, and we took it to a festival, Karlovy Vary, outside of Prague. People waiting just to say, oh, this happened to me.
Right.
And I was shocked that it wasn't just what it was like to be a parent. It was like five different ways in that people were picking up on. And I would say that the people who were champions of it at Sundance picked up on all of the things that I hoped people would. Nothing was tepid. People were either nasty or they were huge champions.
Right.
And I liked that. And I hope that we can get more support as we're coming out now.
So, Julie, let me just sneak in a time stamp question. I've done a lot of these stories. Okay. I think it was you said in an interview with The Hollywood Reporter, my day job, that you had come to realize that you had been harassed by James Toback.
Oh, yeah. It wasn't a sudden realization. It was just that, I mean, I always knew I had been harassed by James Toback. I'd never said anything.
Not a subtle player.
It was after I think it was Selma Blair and somebody else had an experience that they reported somewhere. And I immediately got on Twitter just because I felt like they needed to be corroborated and said that when I was like 24, 25 and living on Columbus Avenue, I would walk down the street and this guy came up to me and said, "Hi, excuse me, are you an actress?" And I was like, "Yes." He goes, you're very beautiful. And I just wanted to say that I have this film that I'm casting and I would love you to read for it. And of course, I'm a young actress and I'm like, film? Oh, wow, an audition. He's like, "So would you come back to my apartment and read?" And I was like, "No, thank you." No, you know, like right away, I thought, this feels kind of weird. And I just left. And then about 2 months later, I hear, "Hello, are you an actress?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And
oh,
it's the same. It was all the same language. And I said, "You did this to me before.
Wow.
Do you remember?"
Yeah.
And I was like,
and
I
he
told
was like, "No,
that,
I don't remember because I do this constantly."
And I, you know, and I told somebody about it and they said, "Oh, yeah, he's just known for cruising girls on Columbus Avenue." So when I heard these stories, I felt like it was important for me to tell my story. I mean, you know, I wasn't hurt. I wasn't injured. I was just harassed on the street. So I, by saying that this happened to me, then you're able to say, you're giving your support to the women.
Right. So do we have hope on this subject?
I think so. Yeah, I do. I think we're in the middle of a gigantic culture change. You know, I think there are behaviors that we tolerated because it was simply part of where we thought we were hierarchically in society as women that we won't tolerate anymore. I think that it's hard to change culture, you know, obviously.
Tell me about it.
But I mean, I've never witnessed anything like this in my lifetime. I mean, my mother was somebody who didn't graduate from college until I was in the eighth grade. Her parents hadn't saved any money for her education. And she was the one who said to me, you know, it's important to have an education, to have a job, to have a family. You can have all of that because nobody said that to her, you know, so that was something she provided for herself. So I saw a change from my mother's generation to mine. And then everything sort of seemed to flatline for a while. And it really took me too to bring all this back again.
Julianne Moore is the star and Bart Freundlich is the director of After the Wedding. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Paul Smith and additional help this week from Laura Kondarajian. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.